This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Feels like temperatures in many areas of the South have been well above 100 degrees. And in Texas and Louisiana, the extreme heat is being blamed on at least 14 deaths. CBS's Omar Villafranca.
In Houston, roads buckled as highs hit 99 degrees. In Dallas, temperatures outside felt like 115.
You want to get started early when it's cooler.
Kyle Davis says his roofing business is more dangerous in the summer.
So they know when they're not feeling right, something's not right, they need to come down and take a long break.
James Horn spent the day installing air conditioners at homes for older people that don't have them.
It's very hot in there, multiple in there, so there's a lot of body heat on top of just the house in general, just containing heat.
Detroit's air quality ranks among the worst in the world as Canadian wildfire smoke lingers in the area. Gary Shields is wearing a mask.
My throat has been sore. I've been coughing. It's really, and I've been indoors mostly for the last 3 days.
Poor air quality alerts are up from the Midwest to Washington, D.C. Federal judges in Kentucky and Tennessee have blocked portions of bans on gender-affirming care for youth. They've blocked portions of the law that would have banned transgender youth from accessing puberty blockers and hormone therapy. In Tennessee, the judge did not block a ban on gender-affirming surgeries for youth. The White House says President Biden is using a common medical device to treat an obstructed airway when he sleeps. CBS's Stephen Portnoy reports.
Reporters noticed the marks on the president's face from the CPAP machine, which his aides say he's been using in recent weeks to improve his sleep. Mr. Biden's history with sleep apnea was first disclosed when he ran for vice president in 2008. But his most recent updates from the White House physician have not mentioned it.
With the 4th of July holiday looming, there are warnings about lifeguard shortages and dangerous riptides. More from CBS's Allison Keyes.
Almost everyone loves the beach and frolicking in the waves, but at least 11 people have died in the last 10 days thanks to riptides along the Gulf of Mexico, mostly in Florida. Daryl Paul at Panama City Beach Fire Rescue says,
"The safest place to be when you come to the beach is near a lifeguard."
And Daniel Noah at the National Weather Service in Florida warns, don't try to outswim one.
Olympic swimmers maybe can swim at 5 miles an hour. What chance does anybody else have?
Allison Keyes, CBS News.
Madonna is rushed to a hospital and into the ICU for treatment of what her manager says is a serious bacterial infection. She's expected to recover, but her celebration tour is postponed until further notice. This is CBS News.
Find great hires fast with Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring solution makes it easy to attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
News is brought to you by Gingras Thompson and Walks, a statewide team of personal injury lawyers getting you the justice you deserve. Call 855-954-1186 for a free consultation.
Here's what you need to know in Western Wisconsin. Good afternoon, I'm Jimmy Kuska. Well, it's a slight chance, but it's been rare this summer to have any chance of severe weather, and we've got that here in western Wisconsin this afternoon. Storms are expected to start from the north and west this afternoon and then move mostly east throughout the evening and overnight, with the main risks being hail and high winds. The DNR says the air quality in Wisconsin is the worst it's been in over a decade. An air quality advisory is in effect through noon tomorrow due to wildfire smoke from Canada. The air is currently unhealthy for everyone in most of the state, and when the air quality gets this low, the DNR says people should spend less time outdoors, especially children and those with health concerns. The city of Eau Claire is planning on creating a TIF district in the old Shopko Plaza. It's an effort to spur development on the southwest side of the city. Also, the Eau Claire City Council voted unanimously to replace the Dewey Street Bridge downtown, which is nearly a century old. The project would come with a $14.2 million price tag. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Kuska.
The law firm of Gingras Thompson & Walks has a track record of making life-changing, positive differences for their clients. $5.25 million to a woman who suffered brain injuries and her husband passed away when struck by a drunk driver. $1 million to three different individuals injured by drunk drivers. $1 million settlement to a man injured in a motorcycle accident. Call Gingras Thompson and Walks, 855-954-1186.
Calling to win, Gingras Thompson and Walks, GTWLawyers.com.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Why a RICO charge counselor? What's that mean to the layperson?
It was written for Organized Crime, Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. That's where RICO comes from. The notion that you've got an entity whose purpose is to try to perpetuate some crime. It's more than just a singular event. It is a composite of kind of a corporate conspiracy doing things toward this illegal end.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6
on your local civic media radio station and on the app. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Gary from Sussex. Hey, Gary.
Whose birthday is it? Is it both you guys' birthday or is it Mike's?
It's my birthday today. Mike's was 2 days ago.
I'm going to sing a happy birthday, and I'm going to sing it the right way. Happy birthday to you, Mr. President of his radio station and his sidekick.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6
on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
Well, most of that is good news. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So this is a really interesting story. Yellow Freight Corporation, they are one of the last of the National Master Freight Agreement, LTL, freight companies in the country. They have filed a $137 million lawsuit against the International Brotherhood of Teamsters because the Teamsters won't give them everything they want. They don't. They won't rip up the contract and go into fire mode to allow the company to save itself from all of the bad decisions that it's made over the last 50 years. Now, a little personal insight, as someone who has spent 30 years in the LTL industry, Yellow is one of those companies that everything they touched, they destroyed. Think Carolina, think Roadway Express, think a bunch of things that they have absorbed and destroyed. And it's not surprising they're in the mess that they're in. Also, given the fact that Donald Trump gave them $700 million and they figured out how to squander that as well. Now it's, hey, workers, we want more. And the union and Sean O'Brien, the president of the Teamsters, said, not going to do it. And here to share some thoughts on this creative tactic of we're just going to sue you for a gazillion dollars. I've asked Eric Fink to come talk with us. Eric is a associate professor of law at the Elon School Law School. Eric, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, always a pleasure, Rick.
So, you know, I'm looking at this and, you know, the only word I can come up with is creative. This is a creative way to evade collective bargaining. This is a creative way to get away from sitting down and negotiating. This is a way of saying, hey, we're going to use the Supreme Court or the court system to beat you over the head, and we don't care about your workers or you.
Yeah, I can think of other words than creative, but they're probably not suitable for a family radio program. So we'll stick with creative.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's a lot of irony in this lawsuit. Because, of course, what the company is accusing the Teamsters of is refusing to negotiate, okay? And, I took the time this afternoon to read the complaint. There's a lot of detail in it, which is to say the company takes a whole lot of swipes at the Teamsters, both specific swipes at how the Teamsters have responded to the company's attempt to restructure and its impact on jobs. And more broadly, they seem to have a lot of fun mocking Teamsters president Sean O'Brien And there's a lot of stuff in here about what he puts on his Twitter feed. They seem real, again, I'll try to keep my language clean. They seem very sad that he has mocked the company and its bad business decisions publicly on Twitter. And you know, those of us who, in the labor movement or supportive of the labor movement who follow this stuff have already seen that Sean O'Brien is what we call a poster. He is a master of Twitter. And so he's made Yellow Freight sad, I guess. And so they have decided that because their bad business decisions and their inability to get the Teamsters to agree to their plan, because that's led to a decline in the apparently a decline in the company's share price or its ratings by the corporate review world, that this is somehow the Teamsters' fault, and they think that they get to sue the Teamsters for not just $137 million. That's the starting point. They claim that they've already lost $137 million. It's not clear where they get that number from. And then they say in the lawsuit that they might potentially lose a whole lot more, that it will be the Teamsters' fault if the company folds. And they also want attorney's fees and punitive damages, I guess, to, you know, terrorize any labor union that has the temerity, right, the audacity, not to just do what the boss says. And you're right. This is going back. When I teach labor law, I start, and the students wonder why, I start in the 1800s. And one of the things I look at is bosses, companies using the courts to basically declare unions negotiating efforts to be against the law. Okay, they used to call it criminal syndicalism or criminal conspiracy. Here they're calling it breach of contract, but this is not really a breach of contract suit. They call it a breach of contract suit for legal reasons, but it's really a boo-hoo, you've been mean to me lawsuit.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's amazing that they're doing this. But again, this is the kind of moment that we're in, Eric. I mean, you look at the Supreme Court just came down with a case and a decision that, you know, 20 years ago would have been unthinkable to bring into a courtroom. But, you know, the Teamster, the cement case out in Seattle has gone the way of the companies.
Yeah. And this is a little bit different, you know, without getting too much into the stuff I would teach in law school. That case involved a strike. And so the issue there was when the strike started, the workers walked off their jobs. Well, right. That's kind of how a strike worked. And so the company says because they left their cement mixer trucks, that this caused property damage. And the Supreme, so historically, I know you know this, Rick, your listeners might not know, there's an old case called Garmin, where the Supreme Court decades ago said, look, Congress passed the Labor Act in the 30s. This is supposed to govern labor relations. And this was, among other things, supposed to guarantee labor peace by requiring bargaining and creating a whole procedure and structure with the National Labor Relations Board and unfair labor practices. And so the Supreme Court in Garmin says, that's the law that governs. If you've got a beef with a union, you go through that procedure. You're not allowed to bring a state law tort suit, you know, like you would for a traffic accident or medical malpractice, and sue the union for that. Because, you know, if what the union is doing, if the basis of your suit is conduct by the union that is at least arguably protected under the Labor Act. Now, strikes are protected under the Labor Act. So right. That was the union's position. The Supreme Court said that there is an exception, and there was some recognition that claims for actual property damage, like, you know, if strikers trespass and they smash up, they set fire to the factory or something, those suits have been allowed.
Sure.
The Supreme Court did not say necessarily that the company wins in that cement case, but they said they are allowed to sue in state court. All right. This case is different. Because at the very least, I have to credit, right, because I'm a law teacher, I got to, maybe reluctantly or half reluctantly, credit the company's lawyers for at least following the letter of the law. The Labor Act does allow either a company or a union or an employee to bring a lawsuit in federal court for breach of a collective bargaining agreement. That would normally be a breach of contract suit in state court, like if you sued, you know, a store for not selling you what they promised. But a breach of a collective bargaining agreement, that's a federal lawsuit, and that goes to federal court. So that's what Yellow Freight says they're doing here. They frame this by saying that we've got a contract with the Teamsters, the master freight agreement, right? Yellow Freight, the background to this is Yellow Freight wants to restructure. They want to reorganize. They're losing money. Their business is, you know, like you say, they're not very good at what they do. And so they say, we've got to restructure to stay competitive. So they want to combine. They've got these subsidiaries. They want to combine these subsidiaries and combine some of the terminals and combine some of the operations, okay? And they say, we have a right to do that. That's a management decision. And yes, that's true, okay? They have, under the law, if they want to merge their operations, they have to bargain with the union over how that affects employees. And the big way that that affects are things having to do with seniority. Because as you know, anytime there's a company merger, part of that is to downsize the workforce. Company is open about this. They're not pretending that's not the case here. Under the, you know, contract, those layoffs usually are go in order of seniority. And people with seniority usually have rights to bid on whatever jobs remain and so on. So under the contract, the company admits we have to bargain with the Teamsters at least over how to work out all these seniority issues. Okay, fine. The contract has this process for basically a joint labor management committee to work that out. So what the contract says is the company says, here's our reorganization plan, okay? And we want the committee to come up with how, you know, a way to deal with all the seniority issues, the impact on the employees. The company claims that the Teamsters have not engaged in that process in good faith. And they say that the Teamsters have taken advantage of this and the company's desperate need, you know, to accomplish this restructuring to, according to the company, hold the company over the barrel to get wage concessions and other stuff. And the company claims that President O'Brien is using this as an opportunity to show, you know, to flex his muscles and show how strong he is, okay? And they say that as if that's not okay, like as if that's not what unions are supposed to do. Exactly. Unions are supposed to protect their workers' interests.
And no, so, you know,
I'm reading this and thinking, which part of this, you know, is it that they say is improper? But the bottom line, right, to bring it to a close so you can ask another question, their claim is that the Teamsters have, you know, the Teamsters have not participated in this committee process, have refused to do that, have refused to meet, and that, you know, that this is a breach of the contract, and so they're entitled to sue. So, you know, one of the things that's interesting is, again, Rick, as you know, a lot of your listeners probably know, almost every union contract has a grievance and arbitration procedure. The Supreme Court has repeatedly said, whether in union contracts or consumer contracts, if the contract says you have to arbitrate your contract disputes, you don't get to bring a lawsuit in federal court or state court or any court. You got to go through the grievance and arbitration procedure.
Right.
In their complaint, Yellow tries to get around that. I don't find it very convincing, but, you know, we'll see what the court says. They claim that they're not required to bring this through the grievance process because we're demanding $137 million in economic damages, and we couldn't get that from the grievance procedure. Now, the usual answer to that, if it was an employee trying to sue for breach of contract, would be, yeah, too bad, because that's what the contract says.
Exactly.
You bargained for, right? So I'm sorry that you would rather get some other remedy, but that's not what you got. That's not what you're entitled to.
So in looking at this, Eric,
the first question that I have is, what's the court going to do about that? You know, I don't know. I haven't spoken to anyone from the Teamsters. I haven't seen their response, but I'm guessing that will be part of their answer, is that the court should throw this out, first of all, at least until the company exhausts the grievance procedure. You know, and then you get to the supposed merits of the lawsuit, which is, did the union really, even assuming that the union did all these things that the company claims they did, does that really breach the contract? And can they really show that this, you know, can they really attribute $137+ million worth of losses? You know, is that really the union's fault?
Yeah, when I saw this first, and look, you're the legal expert here. When I first saw it, I just saw this as a bargaining ploy, saying, you know, it's like an employer kind of strike, if you will. You know, workers go out on strike and withhold their labor. This is them going, we're going to sue you for everything you've got, and force them back to the table, because, you know, as I understand, as people have told me secretly, you know, there are negotiations going on. It's just that the union's not going to give the company what they want, which is basically eviscerating all of the work rules. You know, look, if you're struggling because you've got a bad business model and you've run yourself into the ground, and you're not going to save yourself by abusing your workers. That seems like a sane, rational position to stand on.
Yeah. No, I read, even again, just reading the company's own version in the complaint that they filed, that's what it looked like to me, that their real complaint is that the union is engaging in hard bargaining, and that the union are doing a good job of it, right? And that the union are not giving the company exactly what it wants. And they're really upset that, you know, President O'Brien is open about this, and you know, not being coy about it.
Yeah, and their feelings are hurt. So last
and
question.
I said it'd be, it's ironic when you consider that that's the stuff that companies normally do, of course, when unions try to negotiate. The companies, I'll go there, right? Shit, stall, and delay, right? That's what happens all the time. And the company says, yeah, well, man, you know, what are you going to do about it? And there's usually not much, you know, the union can go to the labor board, and how long does that take, and where does that usually get you? So it's really pretty cheeky to see a company turn around and accuse the union, at worst, of doing what companies do all the time, but saying, oh, but we're entitled to $137 million plus punitive damages.
So last question I've got for you, because, you know, look, I look at our court system, especially our Supreme Court, seems to be heavily weighted toward corporate interests. It seems to be that they're in the pocket of the Chamber of Commerce, that, again, these kind of suits 20 years ago would have never been filed or even reported on. But we're in a different era right now, Eric, and you know this as well as anyone.
Yeah.
So do you think this gains any ground if this gets in front of a Trump appointee? Do you think this gets to the Supreme Court? Do you think this makes it that far, or does this get cut off at the knees?
No, that's the real concern, right? Because if this was 10, 20 years ago, I don't think that this would go anywhere. I don't think that a sensible company lawyer would have even advised proceeding with this lawsuit. But nowadays, all bets are off. Even if it goes to an honest judge at the initial level, I don't know who the judge will be. They filed this, I think, in Kansas. I don't know who any of the judges are in Kansas. But, you know, what they're counting on is that then they'll appeal to the appellate courts, which are heavily stacked with, you know, right-wing judges, and ultimately to the Supreme Court, which is, of course, dominated by right-wing anti-union judges, and has shown that it is willing to let employers sue unions for doing what unions exist to do legally under the law. And that's what's scary. It's easy for me as a law professor to say, you know, this looks like nonsense. This looks unmeritorious under the precedent. But I don't know how much that precedent really matters anymore.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't bet on this disappearing very easily, which worries me.
Yeah, I mean, this opens up a whole new...
If it goes far, even if they don't ultimately win, if they can survive a motion to dismiss, if they can drag this out in court, other employers are going to try this. And they don't really care about winning. They don't really think they're going to get $137 million, or at least that's not the point. The point is they think they're going to bankrupt the union, or at least exhaust the union and deplete its support in the meantime.
And ultimately, that's what the entire right wing agenda has been about over the last 40 years, with these no rights at work laws and all of these decisions that have given these companies the ability to sue. It's incredible. So this could be the next avenue. It will be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah.
But Eric, I appreciate you taking some time sharing your expertise. I will definitely have you back as this continues, because I think this is important.
All right. Well, Rick, always a pleasure, and thanks for everything you do to keep the labor story in the public eye.
Thanks so much, Eric. Appreciate the time. Eric Fink, Associate Professor of Law at Elon Law School. Want to hear your thoughts. Is this a big deal? Do you think this could be something? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Well, certainly going to be an interesting, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with this lawsuit. Yellow Freight, you know, suing the Teamsters for $137 million. Now, understand, Yellow Freight, you know, I've never been a fan, to be honest. They, back in, I think it was like 2004, they ended up in basically a hostile takeover, buying a Broadway Express, which had been a $6 billion company. They were the leader of the LTL industry. You know, they were the big company. Yellow was number two. They were about a $6 billion company. And somehow Yellow figured out how to turn two $6 billion companies into one $6 billion company. And now you see that, you know, all of the debt they took on, all of the bad decisions they made over the years, the enormous number of changes of operations that cost millions of dollars over the years have now come home to roost. And the union saying, look, you know, show us a plan that's going to help you save yourself, but not screw our employees, screw our members. You know, what they want is they want to throw out the entire contract, and they want to work people like dogs. And the union saying, no, we want to make sure that we get, if we're going to save this company, we've got to benefit from it too. Look, Yellow employees, YRC employees, Roadway employees, all of them all along the line have given massive wage concessions for years now. I mean, this is years they've given massive givebacks, have frozen their pensions, have cut their healthcare contributions time and time again. The Teamsters Union is the only reason Yellow is still in business. And there's a point at which the union's going, look, you've got to figure out how to do this, but we're not giving up all of the work rules, and you're not going to be able to stick it to our members. Also, speaking of not sticking it to the members, looks like a strike at UPS is imminent, as the Teamsters today walked away from the bargaining table because, well, UPS didn't come with anything. The union, I guess, is now saying, give us your last, best, and final, and we will figure it out. If this is the best you got, then a strike is imminent, and this is where it's going to go. And I looked at the numbers. I don't know how you can not strike, given the fact that this is one of the most profitable companies in the country, $13.9 billion in profit, and they're demanding a cost-neutral contract. Get out of Dodge. There's no way that can be accepted. Just not. I do want to address one thing. We had a caller in a little bit ago, didn't want to come on air. On the Trump-Hillary thing, I guess we're going to have to revisit that for a second. He claims that, and he's actually right, that Trump came out against the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. And Hillary was not out against it. Hillary was, she, I think she was for it, And I agree that that was problematic. Now, she had some ideas on, trade enforcement and a whole bunch of things to try and pull this in. What Democrats never did and what Obama never did, and I said during the whole TPP fight, how you should have sold it was, this is our way of taking on China. This is our way of ensuring that we organize all of the countries around them so that we can hold them in check. That never happened. And look, I'm not a free trader, and I get it. A lot of people look to Trump, who was not a free trader, who said he was against the TPP, and a lot of people voted in that way. Hillary did not run on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, and it was basically dead. But, to be honest, that could have affected some people's votes. I'm fully aware of that. And I think this is where I come back to Biden. I come back to Jelly Bucket Joe. We're not talking about those kind of things. I think we've kind of learned our lessons. I think Democrats have finally figured out, and we've kind of purged some of the DLC folk, gotten rid of some of the neoliberals. That's a good start. And this is where, again, working class voices, working class representatives, people who know what it's like to lace up a pair of boots and put on a pair of gloves and do an honest day's work. Those are the people you want in the halls of Congress, not some of these kooks that we see today. Thanks so much for your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Back after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
This day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day that the U.S. Congress passed the Walsh-Healy Public Contracts Act. The bill had been proposed by the Secretary of Labor, Francis Perkins. The act was part of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal effort to combat the ravages of the Great Depression. The year before, the President and Secretary Perkins had faced a major setback in their New Deal policies. The Supreme Court had declared the National Industrial Recovery Act, part of the recovery plan, unconstitutional. The President and his team went back to the drawing board to develop new strategies. Secretary Perkins told the president, quote, "I've got two bills locked in the lower left-hand drawer of my desk against an emergency." One of those bills became Walsh-Healy. The act declared that any manufacturer with a contract of more than $10,000 with the U.S. government for goods or supplies had to abide by certain rules. They had to pay the prevailing minimum wage. They had to allow their employees to work an 8-hour workday and a 40-hour work week. They could not hire boys under the age of 16 or girls under the age of 18. Companies could not use prison labor, and the companies had to provide a safe and healthy workplace. This New Deal Act stood up under the scrutiny of the courts. Even more importantly, the act was a precursor to the Fair Labor Standards Act. The Fair Labor Standards Act was passed the next year, providing many of these same provisions to the general workforce. The Walsh-Healy Act remains in effect today, protecting workers who are employed by companies that manufacture goods for the U.S. government. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
In Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, Humpty Dumpty scornfully declares that when I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean. So what does woke mean? It's become the pet political aspersion that today's kooky right-wing hucksters hurl at liberals. But the hurlers would be whopper-jawed to learn that it was actually coined by and for progressives. Indeed, it admonishes people to be awake to the dangers posed by hate-filled bigots and reactionaries like today's right-wing extremists. Surprising historical tidbit. The first person reported to have used the word was Huddy Ledbetter, the legendary black blues artist known as Leadbelly. Among his many classic songs was Scottsboro Boys, about 9 black teenagers falsely accused in 1931 of raping 2 Alabama white women. As a black musician who traveled the back roads of the Jim Crow South, Leadbelly warned others to pay attention when in a viciously racist state. Best stay woke, he cautioned. But out of blind ignorance, blind arrogance, or both, today's adapters of the Jim Crow mentality have perverted common sense wokeness into a verbal whip to lash African Americans, immigrants, Democrats, women, LGBTQ people, and all others they don't like. Pretty much everyone who looks, thinks, prays, and acts different from them. How kooky? They've declared librarians, science, Mickey Mouse, and Bud Light to be their evil enemies. Don't be woke, they bark, demanding autocratic, plutocratic, and theocratic laws to coerce compliance with their own retrogressive bigotries. This is Jim Hightower saying, bear in mind that this is no longer a fringe cult, but the mainstream of the Republican Party, including its top congressional leaders, presidential wannabes, and state officials. Actually, you can easily comprehend what these Humpty Dumpties really mean by their Don't Be Woke war cry. Just substitute the word sane for woke.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Some real interesting things happening around education in my state of Pennsylvania. First, the state Supreme Court has come down with a ruling on funding. And we've got the Democratic governor coming out in front of in favor of vouchers. And I'm going, kind of hope that that wasn't going to be something. I mean, I was hoping... I'm hoping we weren't going to follow the Iowa model, hoping we weren't going to go down that. What, child labor laws next? But here to share some thoughts on the decision and what's going on with the governor, I've asked Chris Lilienthal to come talk with us. Chris is the Assistant Director of Communications at PSEA, the Pennsylvania State Education Association. Chris, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rick.
So walk me through. Let's start with the Supreme Court decision, because I'm not sure this got a lot of attention. Where are we? What is it? What's it going to do and why?
Sure. So, you know, this is a case that has been years in the making, and there was a very lengthy trial, a ton of expert testimony, evidence introduced that made the case for the fact that Pennsylvania's public schools are inequitably funded. And what that means in a nutshell is that not all schools are getting the same amount of resources to give every student in every zip code that same opportunity. And so when the court ruled back in February initially, they ruled that our public school funding system was so broken that it violates Pennsylvania state constitution. And I want to emphasize, this is a case all about how our public schools are funded. So fast forward now to the last week of June, we are finally at that point where all the parties are coming together in Harrisburg to negotiate a state budget. And as usual, education funding is a huge piece of that and huge point of discussion. And that's where we are right now. And so up to this point, we've been advocating very strongly to focus on what the court told us to focus on, and that is fixing Pennsylvania's broken school funding system for our public schools.
You know, it's interesting. I've had conversations with people who have said that, you know, their thought is that the belief structure is that all kids in the state get, you know, the same kind of resources. It's almost like they're pushing this idea there's a backpack full of cash that each kid gets, and it's all the same across because the state doles it out. And the reality is in Pennsylvania, we've got, 500 school districts, over 67 counties, and they all have different funding levels because they've all got different, you know, property tax levels because of how we fund our education system. So I think there's a lot of education that has to be on that side of it, that it really is unfair, because what you get is, you know, a lot has to do with what your zip code is.
That's absolutely right. And it's wrong. You know, it's wrong. And the problem is that Pennsylvania as a state needs to be kicking in more state funding to equalize the fact that, you know, some communities are going to have a wealthier tax base than others. And some communities are going to have robust commercial businesses that are going to be providing that tax base. And some places are going to be more residential. You know, some are inner city, some are very rural, some are suburban. It's just Pennsylvania is a huge state. It is so diverse, just in terms of the size of and shape of communities, as well as ethnically and racially diverse. And so Pennsylvania as a state has a responsibility to be funding our schools in a way that makes sure that every kid gets a fair shake, gets the same opportunity, regardless of his or her zip code or where they happen to grow up. Well, and that's what this case is all about.
Really. Right. I mean, it seems to me, look, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and it was always curious to me that, you know, the schools in our neighborhood never got the same kind of resources that the suburbs got, and there was no mechanism to help make sure that that happens. And when you look in some of these high poverty areas, like where I grew up, you would think you would need more resources to help people catch up. If truly education is that great equalizer, that you would need more resources into high poverty areas than you might in other areas, because there are a lot more problems in high poverty communities than you have in the wealthier areas. Or at least that's my thought. I'm curious yours. Yeah.
No, that's an excellent point, Rick, because when you talk about high poverty communities, you might be talking about students who don't have access to meals. They might be hungry. They're coming to school without proper nutrition. They could be homeless. They could be home insecure. They, you know, moving from one house to the next. All of that is going to have a tremendous impact on a student's ability to learn. So you're absolutely right. We need to be looking at making sure that the resources are there for the academic instruction, that, you know, so that they have great teachers, they have great support staff, but also so that there's funding there for meals, there's funding there for support. Community schools is an idea that's gotten a lot of attention in the last couple of years. Erie County, the Erie School District in particular, has been doing a really amazing job developing some community school models within their elementary and high school. That's the direction we need to be going. But of course, all of that takes, you guessed it, more state funding.
Yeah, takes resources. No, look, I go resources. Back to when I was a kid, Chris. You know, in the summertime, the local Puritas Elementary School, the local elementary school during the summertime, you could line up around 11 in the morning and you'd get a hot lunch. And for a lot of the kids, and it wasn't much, like grilled cheese sandwiches, beans and wieners, something like that. But for a lot of those kids in that line, that was the only hot meal they would get all day, because that was the kind of area that we were in. And I remember, you know, when Reagan came in, Mr. Ketchup is a Vegetable, and eviscerated all of those programs. And, you know, the reality is those kids went hungry.
You're right. Yeah. I mean, we cannot think that, you know, on what planet are you able to go about your life and work through, whether it's school, whether it's a job, on an empty stomach? You need to have nutrition. It's just basic to being a functioning human.
You got
to
pull yourself up, your bootstraps, in particular. Chris. Bootstraps. Yeah. Pull yourself up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what? If you want kids to be able to pull themselves up to the desk and actually sit down and get their work done, they need to have a healthy breakfast. They need to have a healthy lunch.
Yeah, and the stability of what school offers, and again, I go back to my experience in a housing project, and the kind of problems that, you know, this is back in the 70s. I mean, it's much worse today than it was back then with all of the other social problems we have. It just seems like the hunger games that we're playing with education is not getting us where we need to be. And the sad reality is what's happening is we're pitting wealthier communities against poorer communities instead of saying, hey, how can we be one community, ensure that we have an educated populace to be good citizens and you know, good workers and all that stuff too, but good citizens.
Yeah, I think that's when you go back and you look at this court case that, you know, actually started about a decade ago, the process started, the trial lasted for several months. If you tuned into any of those expert witnesses and the families who were testifying and the school officials and the teachers, you know, the story that was told is a lot what you're talking about here, Rick. The fact that there are too many districts in this Commonwealth where students don't have what they need to be to learn, to be safe, to be in a healthy and a safe environment. And we need to do a better job. And that was the direction that the judge gave us. Do better.
Do better.
Come up with a remedy for this.
No, absolutely. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Chris Lilienthal. He's the Assistant Director of Communications at PSEA, the Pennsylvania State Education Association. You can check out their website, psea.org. We'll get links out on social media. Now, this brings us to the Willy Wonka Hunger Games of education. Because I guess the golden ticket is back, I guess. Is this what I'm hearing? And we've got a Democratic governor in Josh Shapiro, who I think has been doing a very good job. I'm questioning this, but I guess the golden tickets are back.
Yeah, you're talking about vouchers here. You know, it's the late stages of the budget negotiations. when this process started, when the governor introduced his proposed budget in March, it was all about getting us on track to be making those investments in our schools to address learning needs, to address mental health, to address building safety and meals. And now all of a sudden the conversation has been derailed and we're talking about vouchers. We're talking about allocating up to $100 million in state taxpayer dollars that would be taken away from our public schools to give to private and religious schools, the golden ticket, as you like to say. So, you know, this is something that the Senate Republicans have been advocating for, and Governor Shapiro has said that he's open to this idea. All eyes right now are on the House of Representatives, a one-seat majority there held by House Democrats. And, you know, right. So far they have shown no interest whatsoever in this proposal. They put forth a budget just a few weeks ago that actually stepped up what Governor Shapiro called for our public schools. They included some Level Up funding. Level Up is a great program that went into effect during the Wolf administration that directs an additional amount of money to the 100 poorest school districts in the state to kind of get them closer to that equity place where we want them to be.
Right.
So, you know, we have some really good people in Harrisburg working for the right things, but we also have some deep pockets, some very well-heeled groups funded by right-wing billionaires who are looking to push this idea of vouchers.
But again, this voucher idea, and I go back to this, you know, the golden ticket, as I call it, because I remember when it first came out, we had State Senator Mike Fulmer on the program who was, you know, the big champion of this. He proposed a piece of legislation that he didn't read or write. But he told me flat out, he said, and I asked him, I said, look, if I get one of these golden tickets and I can go anywhere, I have this thing that every parent wants, the best education their kids can get, can I take them anywhere? And he's like, absolutely. So if I'm going to take them to, let's say, Philadelphia, to, you know, Abington Friends School, which is about $50,000 a year for kindergarten, will it cover this? And he told me flat out, yes, you're going to be able to take this golden ticket, this wonderful voucher, this amazing thing, and you're going to be able to get your kid that $50,000 a year private education. And I said, I think you didn't read your bill, because that's not what these are, is it?
No, not at all. We're talking about $5,000 grants, $10,000 grants. But, you know, really, the bigger issue here is, what are you getting for that? You're getting this voucher for students to go into a private school setting. There is absolutely no student academic accountability once they head over to this private school. So once we hand out these vouchers, once we've given them thousands of dollars in taxpayer money, we have no idea whether that student is doing better, doing worse, whether that student is experiencing any additional issues, whether it be mental health or otherwise, because there is absolutely no accountability for how this money is handled. Right. once it leaves the Harrisburg. So, you know, we're looking at all this and we're saying, wait, okay, so there's a ton of accountability metrics in place for our public schools, but we're going to hand out these taxpayer dollars and have no idea if they're actually helping students.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
It's a huge concern.
No, it is. It's a huge concern where this money goes and the accountability and transparency and all this, and who gets them as well. I mean, the reality is what we've seen in other places, and you're the expert on this, but what I've seen in other places is these voucher schemes, the money seems to just go to people who are already sending their kids to private schools or religious schools. It just seemed to be a windfall. It didn't actually help the people that were told it's supposed to be helping. In fact, what I'm understanding on this, and you can help me with these Lifeline scholarships that they're calling them, we're talking about the worst performing schools, kids who are in the worst performing areas, getting this golden ticket and going where? I mean, this is my other problem. In these areas, what other options are there that you're going to get for a couple of thousand dollars? Again, parents in these areas don't have the money to put food on the table most of the time. How are they going to afford a private school education?
Right, right. You know, we talk about school choice and parent choice, but really this is about the private school's choice. They get to choose who they accept and who they don't accept. And you're absolutely right, Rick. There's no income limitations whatsoever in this Lifeline Scholarships bill. So a very wealthy Pennsylvanian who is already, sending kids to a private school setting can tap into this. And we have no sense of, what happens with that student. We have no accountability on how those funds are spent.
Is there any way in your mind, because I've had people say, well, if the money's not coming out of the public school, why does it matter? Is there any world where that happens, where the money that they're going to spend on these pet projects, vouchers, charter schools, whatever. Is there any world where that doesn't harm public education?
No, not at all. I mean, it is absolutely impossible to structure a private school voucher program that doesn't come at the expense of our public schools, because it's not as if we have some magic source of money. It all comes from one place. It comes from you and me and the rest of taxpayers of Pennsylvania, Rick. And so we have a budget, and it's about priorities. It's about what is important to us. And we cannot leave our public schools in a state where the system is broken, where they need these resources to meet the basic needs of their students. We cannot leave them in the lurch and direct hundreds of thousands or hundreds of millions of dollars in state taxpayer dollars to private and religious schools with no accountability whatsoever.
No, I'm with you. Last line of questioning I've got for you, because Pennsylvania is on the on the target board of states to go after in education. In fact, Maniacs for Misery, the Moms for Liberty group, they're having their big powwow, I guess, this weekend in Philadelphia here in Pennsylvania, because this is ground zero for the attack on public education. I'm curious your thoughts of this group and the kind of organizing they are doing. Because look, I love people who have energy. I just wish they'd use it in a positive direction.
Yeah, one of the things that is troubling about some of the messaging, some of the rhetoric that you hear from Moms for Liberty is this suggestion that parents and teachers are clashing with each other. The truth is, I talk to members all across the Commonwealth. Our teachers and our support professionals, they work hand in hand with the parents in their communities. They want to have those conversations with their students' parents, because they know that when you have engaged parents and when you have engaged teachers working together, that's what's going to get our students to where they need to be, to get them on the road to success. Unfortunately, Moms for Liberty has taken this very adversarial relationship. They think that teachers and parents are enemies, and that's simply not the case.
No, I think they want to create that environment. I think this, I know that we've got a billionaire in this state who's funding this stuff heavily with the goal of destroying teachers' unions and public education and all this, so that, Education Incorporated money can line their pockets. But I'm with you. I don't see that same kind of tension. I see people trying to cause it, but I'm not seeing it on the ground. Chris, yeah. I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work you guys do. And thanks so much for the update.
Thank you, Rick.
I want to hear your thoughts. Any thoughts on the vouchers? Have you seen a place where this works? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. President Grover Cleveland had a growing problem. The nation was in the midst of a deep depression. Unrest amongst working people was mounting. The workers at the Chicago Pullman Palace car factory had declared a boycott against the company. They were angry that their wages had been drastically slashed while the rents in Pullman's company town had stayed the same. The boycott of Pullman cars threatened to snarl railroads throughout the nation. And on this day in labor history, the year was 1894. President Grover Cleveland signed the law that declared Labor Day a national holiday. He hoped setting a day aside in recognition of labor would help appease frustrated workers. The bill had been rushed through Congress. It passed both the House and Senate unanimously. But the idea for Labor Day did not start with D.C. politicians. Working people themselves conceived the idea of the holiday. Two men with very similar sounding last names are both credited with coming up with the idea of a Labor Day.
Labor Day. The first was Matthew McGuire. He was a machinist and secretary of the New York Central Labor Union. His birthday was also today in labor history. That year was 1850. The second person credited with calling for a Labor Day was Peter McGuire, a carpenter. The very first Labor Day celebration took place in New York City on Tuesday, September 5th, 1882. The goal was to demonstrate the strength and the spirit de corps of the trade and labor organizations. 5 years later, Oregon became the first state to officially declare a Labor Day holiday. More than two dozen other states had founded similar holidays by the time the National Labor Day was declared. For more than a century, Labor Day has been set aside to remember those who fought for a better life for themselves and their children, and to remember the struggles and celebrate worker solidarity. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Got an email from George. Rick, thanks for talking about the Yellow Freight lawsuit. Yellow has always been bad for the industry. You may remember that they were the first to give discounts after deregulation. They took over and destroyed Roadway Express and Carolina, as you said. They have always been a poorly run company. They have always been bad for workers. Even people who work for them have complained about how bad they are. Look, I worked for a very short period of time, and it was right at the end when Roadway Express was absorbed by them. And it was one of those situations where, you know, originally Roadway had thought about buying Yellow because they wanted to consolidate, the LTL market. They wanted to be the behemoth. But when Roadway looked at it, the numbers, the math didn't add up. They didn't see a way forward, and the executives at the time at Red Roadway, of which they weren't horrible. In fact, you know, those executives had, you know, gone through a spinoff and saved Roadway Express because they were set to go off to die. Years before, you had a situation where Roadway Services, had RPS, they had Viking, Coles, Spartan, they had all these other non-union entities, and they took the union entity and spun it off to die, figuring that all the non-union companies would thrive. Well, all of them went out of business because they were poorly run and had high turnover and all the stuff. I remember, Roadway Express used to say, look, our power is in the dedication of our employees, the longevity of our employees. They used to brag about the fact that they had a less than 2% turnover rate, which in the trucking industry is amazing. The fact that you have people who are skilled, qualified, and dedicated to your company because they make good wages. They have good benefits. They have a future there. And the company was proud of that, and they used that. When Yellow took over, it was all about a fire sale. They got themselves into deep debt. They ended up selling off all of the properties that they had, for peanuts. Basically, it'd be like me buying your house and selling your furniture to pay the mortgage, and then when the furniture's all sold, it's taking the aluminum siding off the side of the house and selling that for scrap metal. That's basically what Yellow did, and they've been run poorly. They took a company that were the number one and number two carriers in the country, and they destroyed it. And look, people were brand specific, and I remember when they tried to combine the companies. People didn't want Yellow in their facility, and people didn't want Roadway in their facility. And when you showed up with a tractor that said Roadway and a trailer that said Yellow, you were making everybody mad, and they lost nearly half their accounts. So am I surprised that they're in trouble? No. They're a poorly run operation. They've always been. So am I surprised that now they're trying a gimmick? No, not even a little bit. Because this was a gimmick from the beginning. They put themselves in a hole right from the beginning. And the reason they did that is because they wanted to have the kind of power to dominate the workforce. And if you stop and you think about what Yellow was able to do, by putting themselves in peril, they were able to claw back 15, 20 years worth of advancements for working people. The wages are stagnant, have been stagnated for, you know, for years now. And they struggle to keep people and get people to come work for them. And I think that's going to get worse if they continue to do what they're doing. So am I surprised that the Teamsters have finally drawn a line in the sand after, you know, a couple of decades now of giving in? No, not at all. Equally, am I not surprised that a corporation is going to figure out how to use the court system to stick it to working people because we've allowed our political gurus to pack the court with the most corporate justices we can find? Absolutely not. So for all those people at Yellow and what used to be YRC and all those places who said, no, Trump's our guy. This lawsuit going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. Because they're not gonna bargain, because they don't think they have to. And if this lawsuit does make it in front of the Supreme Court, it's a coin toss on what they do with it. And then what happens to collective bargaining rights? This is something that